Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. At 10 a.m. on August 22, 1993, fisherman Rick Steiner steers his 50-year-old wooden fishing boat, the Blue Note, through a heavy fog on Alaska's Prince William Sound. It's been 4.5 years since the Exxon Valdez ran aground 10 miles away, spilling 11 million gallons of oil into one of the world's finest fishing grounds. Almost all of that oil is gone now, most of it evaporated or washed out to sea. Rick takes a deep breath, inhaling the smell of salt water and sap from the spruce trees towering overhead. If he closes his eyes, he can imagine it's all back to normal. But everything is not back to normal. The oil is gone, but so is everything else. No birds, no porpoises, even the plankton that used to give the water its beautiful blue-green hue have disappeared, and the water his boat chugs through is eerily clear. The fish are gone, too. The 1993 fishing harvest was a complete disaster. It was estimated 25 million fish would be brought to market this year, but fishermen caught only 4 million, less than a fifth of what was anticipated. The entire Prince William Sound fishing industry is on the brink of collapse, and for Rick and the tens of thousands of others, this means financial ruin. It's also been 4.5 years since Exxon's head of Alaska operations, Don Cornett, told the fishermen that Exxon would make them whole. He said, "If your nets don't fill up, we can take care of that. Just file a claim." But now that the nets are empty and the claims have been filed, Exxon has disappeared. Many of the fishermen have received nothing at all from the company. Now, all of the unanswered claimants have banded together, filing a massive class action lawsuit between the fishermen and Exxon. But the wheels of justice turn slowly. That's why Rick's out here today. As he steers the Blue Note north towards the mouth of the Valdez Channel, he sees other fishing boats emerge, boats of all shapes and sizes, forming a blockade across the half-mile-wide entrance to the Valdez Arm. It's the only shipping passage that leads to the Trans-Alaskan Oil Pipeline Terminal in the town of Valdez, 15 miles away. There are over 100 boats filled with fishermen who are fed up with delayed payments, tired of all the Exxon ads and press releases claiming the spill is over and the sound has recovered. Today, their message for Exxon is simple and direct. Until the company sits down with the fishermen and listens to their concerns, there will be no more oil traffic through the sound. Until then, oil tankers are not getting in or out. A ragtag armada of fishing boats has just cut off 25% of the United States oil supply. A double-decker tour boat churns out of the fog, packed with journalists and photographers from the national press. Rick steps to the prow of his boat and yells through a megaphone.
"We want the world to know that the fishermen of Prince William Sound are going under. Exxon needs to face up to their negligence."
In the distance, Rick sees the 900-foot Attagon Pass emerging from the fog. 7 stories high and 3 football fields long, the tanker dwarfs the fishing fleet. Its deep, chest-rattling horn blows. Leading the way is a Coast Guard helicopter descending fast over the fleet.
"Disperse. Cease and desist."
Rick turns to the other boats.
"It's now or never. We are taking boat names and license numbers. Every boat here is in willful violation of a direct order from the captain of port. If you do not cease and desist now, you will each be fined $250,000 and be sentenced to 6 years in prison."
The press fire away on their cameras, pivoting between the fishermen, the helicopter, and the massive silhouette of the approaching tanker. The tiny fishing boats hold their ground. Watching as slowly, the shape of the tanker starts to shift in the fog, getting wider and wider. It's turning around and heading back out to sea. Rick shoves his fist in the air. The fishermen feel a surge of camaraderie. After years of fighting with Exxon and among themselves, they shout and whoop with one unified voice. And if they can shout loud enough, maybe Exxon will finally listen. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin Modern Classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In our last episode, Ricky Ott went up against the oil industry in Alaska's state legislature, while an even bigger battle loomed on the horizon, the class action lawsuit pitting the residents of Prince William Sound against Exxon. This is episode 4, Winner Take Nothing. It's February 25th, 1990, 3.5 years before the blockade. Alyeska President and CEO James Hermiller sits in a large leather-backed chair squinting at the headlines in the Anchorage Daily News. The words pitted pipeline corrosion jump out at him. Not a good headline for Alyeska, a company created by Exxon and six other big oil companies to manage the pipeline for them. The article underneath the headline is worse. The transatlantic oil pipeline is pitted with rust and in need of major repairs to prevent another catastrophic spill, repairs that could cost billions of dollars. Hermiller takes off his glasses and rubs his eyes. February has been a bad month all around for Alyeska and Exxon. It's almost been a year since the Exxon Valdez ran aground, but the fallout won't go away. At the beginning of the month, survey teams found beaches still covered with thick mats of tar-like congealed oil. Even the beaches that looked clean on the surface had deep deposits of fresh oil hiding underneath. Exxon was forced to send its work crews back out, armed with shovels and construction equipment to dig up the remaining oil. And Exxon's legal issues also took a turn for the worse. A grand jury in Anchorage is weighing federal charges against the company for its role in the spill. The state of Alaska is suing too, as are thousands of individual plaintiffs across the state, including the fishermen who filed for damages against the company. And now this. A front-page news story that not only calls out the current pipeline conditions, it catalogs years of safety infractions, lax maintenance, and negligence in Alyeska's pipeline operations. The kind of details only someone on the inside would know. The reporters don't name their source, but Hermiller is pretty sure he knows who it is. The article has Chuck Hamill's fingerprints all over it. Hamill is an oil broker turned whistleblower who's been hounding Alyeska for years. He used to do business with the company, buying their oil on behalf of clients around the world. But when his clients started complaining that the oil was watered down, his business dried up, and Chuck blamed Alyeska. Of course, Alyeska denied responsibility, but that wasn't good enough for Chuck. Hermiller is sure he's out for revenge. Chuck must have cultivated a source inside Alyeska headquarters who's passing secret company documents to him. Hermiller pauses. It's all starting to make sense. Chuck Hamill and the fisherman Ricky Ott are old friends, and she seems to have a lot of privileged information herself, which she's been passing to government officials in Juneau. Chuck's probably feeding her, too. It's got to be Chuck who leaked those stats to the press so that they can write stories like this. Hermiller folds the paper neatly and sets it on his desk. He knows he'll have to fix those leaks in the pipeline, but that job could take years. Right now, he needs to stop the leak of documents out of Alyeska's headquarters. He needs to find Chuck Hamill's source. So he calls Wackenhut Corporate Security. Wackenhut enforces security around the oil fields and offices for some of Alyeska's parent companies, but Hermiller's not interested in hiring a security guard. Wackenhut has a special investigations division staffed by former CIA officials whose specialty is the dark art of corporate espionage. Hermiller's got a mole in his building, and he needs their help to root him out. 1 month later, Chuck Hamill is sitting with fisherman Rick Steiner in the dimly lit bar of the Captain Cook Hotel in Anchorage, Alaska, chatting about the environmental conference that just wrapped up there. They're old friends, and both are in town for the three-day event. Rick shakes the ice at the bottom of his drink, relaying to Chuck what he heard earlier that day from Ricky Ott. She says the beaches on the Sound are in bad shape, that walking on them feels like treading on a soggy mattress, that all you have to do is kick a stone over, and the oil starts oozing up again. Chuck shakes his head. He says he'll have to check with his guy at Alyeska to see what they're saying on the inside. A woman slides onto the barstool next to Chuck. Tall, thin, tease bangs, lots of makeup, and gives him a smile. Chuck is a people person who makes friends quickly, but tonight he has to read through more literature and pack up for the long flight back home to Virginia. He and Rick finish their drinks and head back upstairs to their rooms. The next day at the airport, as Chuck is boarding his flight, he sees the woman with a big friendly smile again. She introduces herself as Ricky Edelson. She tells him that she saw him at the environmental conference. She works for an environmental law firm called Ecolit. She tells him the company funds major lawsuits on behalf of environmentalists. When Chuck hears this, his ears perk up. He invites her to sit with him. He tells her he has all kinds of sources inside the Alyeska Corporation who are feeding him sensitive information. Edelson smiles. She's all ears. And Chuck can't believe his luck, meeting someone as interested in seeing justice done as he is. They talk the whole way home. But Ricky Edelson isn't interested in justice, at least not for Chuck's cause. And she doesn't work for Ecolit because Ecolit doesn't exist. Ricky Edelson isn't even her real name. It's Ricky Sue Jacobson, and she's an operative in the Special Investigations Division of Wackenhut. And she's not the only one. After Hermiller's call, her team gets busy. They rent a Washington, D.C. office for Ecolit. They buy Save the Whales posters for the waiting room, because they figure that kind of thing will impress an environmentalist like Chuck. They even give their fictional company a fictional board of directors, complete with power players like Donald Trump, all just to woo Chuck Hamill into revealing his source. They flatter Chuck, too. They admire his work, they tell him, and they'd like to use some of their significant resources to help him. Chuck is an easy target. He's nearly gone bankrupt fighting Alyeska, and he's desperate for Ecolit's funding. They park a surveillance RV outside his home, armed with parabolic microphones to record his conversations from a distance. They sift through his garbage and mail. They steal documents and letters from his house, and they tap his phones. 2 weeks after Chuck meets Edelson on the plane, he calls Ricky Ott at her home in Cordova to tell her the good news. He's just teamed up with a powerful new ally called Ecolit, who have seriously deep pockets and are ready to join the fight against Alyeska and the oil companies. Suddenly, their phone call is interrupted by static, a scratching sound cutting in and out unpredictably. It's so loud, Ricky has to hang up. It's been happening a lot lately. Her father thinks it's a wiretap. A few days later, when the loud scratching noise breaks in again, her dad shouts it down. "Listen, you sons of bitches. You people work for some of the richest companies in the world. Can't you at least get some decent equipment so you don't have to interrupt our conversations?" Ricky suspects that whoever is tapping her phones is working for Alyeska, but she can't be sure. Still, she vows to be more careful about what she says on the phone. In Anchorage, 1 week after Chuck's call to Ricky, Alyeska's CEO, James Hermiller, sits at his desk, smiling. He just got a memo from the Wackenhut Corporation. Looks like they've found Hermiller's mole. He's a mid-level Alyeska employee named Robert Scott. Herr Miller doesn't know the guy personally, and now he never will. As of today, Robert Scott is unemployed. Herr Miller will personally make sure of it. The information pipeline running from Alyeska headquarters to Chuck Hamill is completely shut down. Chuck doesn't learn why the information flowing his way dried up until he gets a call from a former Wackenhut operative over a year later. He tells Chuck that he's been had by an Alyeska sting operation. Furious, Chuck calls Congressman George Miller of California. Miller is pro-oil regulation, and he and Chuck have had many phone calls about Alyeska's safety violations over the years. On August 7, 1991, Congressman Miller calls for public hearings on Capitol Hill about the spying rumors. He subpoenas the Wackenhut operatives and Alyeska to testify. It turns out, Hamill wasn't the only one Alyeska was spying on. They tapped the phones of Congressman Miller himself, and Ricky Ott, and the Alaska Attorney General, and a former Alyeska safety inspector. Even a Valdez tour captain they suspected might be allies of Rick and Chuck. The hearing set off a storm of negative newspaper stories and editorials attacking Alyeska. And as a result, James Herr Miller is forced to write apology letters to Chuck Hamill and the people of Alaska for violating their trust, and then publish them in a full-page ad in 8 daily newspapers across Alaska. But by the time the truth comes out, Ricky Ott and the fishermen of Cordova are consumed with an even bigger problem, the fish harvest of 1991. On August 28, 1991, Ricky Ott receives a phone call from Danny Carpenter, the co-captain of her boat, the Ambergris. Normally, Danny's an easygoing guy, but today he sounds worried. He tells Ricky to come to the docks right away. There's something she needs to see. As she approaches the harbor, Ricky passes fishermen gathered in small groups on the docks. They look exhausted. They nod at her with somber faces and look down again. By the time she reaches the boat, she feels like the last guest to arrive at a wake.
Danny, what's going on?
Danny throws open the hatch on the Ambergris fish hold.
Look, they were acting strange even before we hauled them in. Like they were disoriented, lost or something.
Ricky peers down into the hold, filled with pink salmon. Under normal circumstances, it's a welcome sight. But nothing is normal on the Sound anymore. The fish are much smaller than they should be, and lethargic, like they're half dead already.
Everyone's catch is like this, Ricky. No one's ever seen anything like it before, not even the old-timers. There are tons of pinks out there, too many to catch. But they're too small, and the bays are full of dead fish.
Ricky picks up a fish, studies it, and does some quick math. She's a biologist, and knows exactly what's happening here. These fish are 2 years old, making them the first generation of salmon born to the fish that swam through the oil spill in 1989. The oil exposure must have hampered the development of those fish's eggs, and now those eggs have grown into this generation of undersized, lethargic fish that Ricky's examining now. She tosses the fish back into the hold and watches Danny slam the hatch shut on the harvest. No cannery's gonna buy these. There's no market for abnormal salmon. The fish will have to be dumped at sea. And that's just the short-term damage. The long-term picture is even worse. What will happen to the eggs this malformed generation lays, if they're even reproducing? Soon, there may not be any fish left at all. This is the last straw, she thinks. Enough with the publicity, the ad campaigns, the cheery announcements that the Sound is restored. Exxon and the state of Alaska have to answer to this. She doesn't know it yet, but a response is already in the works, and it's going to push Ricky and the fishermen of Cordova to their breaking point.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
On September 17, 1991, 1 month after the worthless pink salmon harvest comes in, Ricky returns home to her A-frame cabin high above Cordova. There's a package waiting for her. Inside is a video cassette bearing the Exxon logo, titled Alaska's Gift of Pink Salmon to the People of the Soviet Union. Ricky pops it in the VCR. Over scenes of fishermen pulling nets full of salmon from Prince William Sound, a narrator proclaims, "This week, the people of Alaska made a historic gift to the people of the Soviet Union, a gift the Exxon Corporation helped make possible." It turns out Exxon paid canneries in the state millions of dollars to process 3 million pounds of the low-quality pink salmon, and then they donated it to poor people in the Soviet Union in what the narrator calls a victory for democracy. The video cuts to an interview with a stocky, crew-cut bull of a man, Alaska's newly elected governor, Wally Hickel. Hickel smiles wide as he speaks. He couldn't be happier to be working with Exxon on this important endeavor. This is Hickel's second time in office. He came out of nowhere on a third-party ticket and stormed into the governor's seat on a pro-business, pro-development platform. A former boxer and construction worker, he's blunt and plain-spoken. He pushed hard to build the Trans-Alaskan oil pipeline in his first term, and now that he's been elected again, he wants to build a new 800-mile natural gas pipeline to run alongside it. "You can't just let nature run wild," he's fond of saying. "A tree looking at a tree doesn't really do anything." Hickel doesn't have any time for environmentalists or their complaints about his plans, and he certainly doesn't have any time to cry about malformed pink salmon harvests in Prince William Sound. The final scene of the video shows a plane taking off for Russia, loaded with pallets of canned salmon. The narrator proclaims, "From an environmental standpoint, the record return of pink salmon to Prince William Sound shows recovery from the oil spill is virtually complete." Ricky shuts off the TV. She can't take any more. This tape was sent to thousands of homes across Alaska to convince the public that Prince William Sound is doing fine. And now, the state of Alaska is endorsing the message, too. And Governor Hickel's not done yet. 2 weeks later, he announces a plea bargain between the state of Alaska, the federal government, and Exxon. The deal settles all state and federal lawsuits stemming from the 1989 oil spill. Exxon will pay a fine of $125 million and $90 million a year for 10 years into a fund that will support the restoration of Prince William Sound. It might sound like a lot, but it's not to Exxon. An official tells reporters, "We're talking about spreading a bill out over 10 years. It's not going to curtail any of our plans." And to the tens of thousands of fishermen who are no longer working, the settlement does nothing to ease their financial pain. By the time that money trickles down to them, they're looking at maybe $3,000 a person. Even worse is what the governor wants to do with that settlement money. He wants to build a road to Cordova and strip log the forests that line the sound. "It's time to move on from the spill," the governor says. But for the fishermen, moving on is not that easy. By 1992, the herring fishery has collapsed completely. Reports of domestic abuse are up. The local mental health clinic is swamped. The townspeople are in debt, with few options of making ends meet. Then, community leader Bobby Van Brocklin kills himself. Bobby was beloved. He was mayor when the Valdez ran aground. In his suicide note, he says the stress of dealing with Exxon and the financial pressure were more than he could bear. A year later, in 1993, when 80% of the fish population has not returned, the fishermen of Alaska reach their breaking point. "Enough is enough," the fishermen decide. "It's time to take a stand. It's time to blockade the pipeline that provides America with 25% of its oil." For 3 days in August 1993, the entire country's attention is on Prince William Sound once again. The first 2 days of the fishermen's blockade strand 7 empty oil tankers in the Gulf of Alaska. By day 3, The situation is growing more and more tense. Alyeska's oil storage units at the pipeline terminal are almost full. If the fishermen don't allow those waiting tankers through soon, there will be nowhere left to put the oil. The 800-mile pipeline will have to shut down completely. That will cost the oil companies millions. It'll deprive the state of Alaska of the oil taxes that fund its government's operating budget. And it'll hit consumers across the country when gas prices spike with 25% less oil available nationwide. Nobody, from the Alaska Governor's Mansion to the White House, wants that pipeline shut down. And that's why Rick Steiner is not out on the water with the other fishermen today. He's 15 miles away in the lobby of the Valdez Westmark Hotel. Rick follows a state official up a flight of stairs and down a long carpeted hallway. He's here to meet with Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt, sent to Valdez by President Clinton to try to resolve the standoff. Babbitt sits waiting for Rick at a table in the corner of a dark suite. He's got close-cropped white hair and tired bags under his eyes. As Rick sits down, Babbitt leans forward, telling Rick he's got a proposal and wants a quick yes or no answer. He says that BP can pressure Exxon to talk, to listen to what Rick has to say. The White House is prepared to put heat on them, too. Babbitt reveals he's also got Governor Hickel's word that he'll use some of the money from the Restoration Fund to research what's happening to the fish in the Sound. Then Babbitt pauses, looking at Rick. This is the best offer you're going to get. Yes or no? Rick thinks for a moment. It doesn't address everything the fishermen want, and it's not going to make the salmon and herring suddenly reappear. But Babbitt's making a commitment to help them, something a lot of government officials have not been willing to do in a long time. That's not something Rick wants to pass on. He needs all the allies he can get. So the two men shake hands. Rick sends word to the fishermen that Exxon has agreed to come to the table, and with that, the blockade is over. By the end of the day, oil tankers are pulling up to the berths of the Valdez oil terminal. But Exxon never comes to the table. Despite pressure from BP and the Clinton administration, they maintain they are not responsible for the decline in fish or the disastrous harvests. It has nothing to do with the spill, and they aren't about to sit down with the same people who are suing them. The fishermen see it differently. Exxon has broken so many promises, and a class action lawsuit is their last shot to recover damages and get justice. But Exxon's not budging. Their message is clear. We'll see you in court. It's 8 p.m. on May 1st, 1994, 8 months after the blockade. Attorney Brian O'Neill is scanning a deposition in the small office space he's rented in downtown Anchorage for the massive class action trial that begins in the morning. O'Neill is the lead attorney for the fishermen, and he's hoping to win over $16 billion in damages from Exxon. Next to him, a cold slice of pizza sits untouched. Behind him, his bare-bones staff sits at beat-up rented tables, reading through last-minute briefs. O'Neill looks out the window at the Anchorage skyline. 3 blocks away, the top 3 floors of the Captain Cook Hotel are completely lit up, Exxon's headquarters for the trial. Behind those windows, hundreds of lawyers, paralegals, energy experts, and assistants are pulling all-nighters. They can't wait to take O'Neill and his fishermen down. O'Neill knows he's facing an uphill battle. Financially, he's outgunned, and legal precedent isn't on his side either. When a British tanker ran aground in the Gulf of Mexico in 1984, oil washed up on the beaches of Galveston, Texas, for a solid 2 weeks. Residents there never saw a dime. In 1978, the Amoco Cadiz crashed on a rocky French shoreline in the English Channel, blackening the beaches of over 100 coastal towns. Those residents sued too, and after 14 years of appeals, they finally received $200 million from Amoco, a tiny award for the worst tanker accident in history. O'Neill wants 80 times that amount from Exxon for the Valdez oil spill, and he feels ready. He's an ex-Marine and a passionate outdoorsman. He's won big environmental damage awards before, even for oil spills. And in the end, he didn't take this case for the money. He wants to win this one because he believes in his clients, and he has a message to send to the corporate world. No matter how big or how wealthy, no company is above the law. The next morning, O'Neill is met by a throng of reporters as he climbs the steps of the U.S. District Courthouse in Anchorage. O'Neill's been up all night.
but he's ready. A reporter asks if he has any comment for the people watching at home. O'Neill replies, "You've got to hit these guys and hit them hard. If something isn't done about what happened in Prince William Sound, it's going to happen next in your own backyard." Then O'Neill hurries up the steps and into the courthouse. After 5 years of waiting, the residents of Prince William Sound are finally getting their chance to confront the company that spilled 11 million gallons of oil in their backyard. And the entire state of Alaska is riveted. Every morning, hundreds of spectators pack the courthouse hallways, trying to get into the courtroom to watch the proceedings. Over the course of the 4-week trial, dozens of expert witnesses produce 10,000 pages of testimony in a case so large and complicated that the judge installs a state-of-the-art computer system to track all of the evidence and display it on a bank of monitors facing the jury. Aerial photos of the spill, ship's logs from the Exxon Valdez, shots of Exxon employees steam cleaning the beaches of the Sound. What isn't on the screens is the evidence O'Neill believes is crucial for his case. Things like personal photos of the fishermen in happier times, evidence showing how their permits and boats have lost value, and photographs of the aftermath of the spill, including the damage caused to the animals and the ecosystem on which the fishermen relied. The judge ruled all of this inadmissible on the grounds that it could make the jurors too sympathetic to the fisherman's case. O'Neill has suspicions about the judge's motivations. Judge Hezekiah Russell Holland is a member of the Petroleum Club, an elite social organization whose members have ties to the oil industry. He got into the club after representing several oil companies, including heavy hitters like Mobil, as an attorney before he became a judge. O'Neill feels like he's fighting with one arm tied behind his back. But he has one other strategy to pursue. It centers on Captain Joseph Hazelwood's history of alcohol abuse and Exxon's negligence in doing anything about it. After Captain Hazelwood's first DUI arrest in 1984, he checked himself into an inpatient alcohol rehab program. Exxon management gave him a 90-day leave of absence and sent him back out on the water again. 1 year later, Exxon memos reported that Hazelwood was drinking again, but no action was taken. As reports of drinking continued to trickle in, Exxon continued to turn a blind eye. Hazelwood was a skilled captain, loved by his crews, who always delivered the oil on time. They even gave Hazelwood and his crew their annual Fleet Safety Awards 2 years in a row. In 1987, Exxon put Hazelwood in charge of their newest tanker, the Exxon Valdez. The last drinking report reached Exxon managers just 2 weeks before the Valdez ran aground. The captain was spotted drunk in San Francisco on the eve of his departure for Alaska. And again, Exxon failed to intervene, and Hazelwood set sail for his final, disastrous Alaska run. O'Neill brings all of this out over the course of the 4-week trial. During breaks and testimony, Exxon employees serve coffee and tea to reporters from silver teapots and china cups with saucers. How can O'Neill, whose office is decorated with folding tables and chairs, compete with that? Fishermen are expecting the worst. This is their last shot, their only hope of maybe, possibly getting something back from the company that took so much away from them. On June 9th, the two sides rest their case. It's up to the jury. All anyone can do now is wait.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself. At amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Mm-hmm.
On the morning of June 13, 1994, after 4 days of deliberations, the jury sends word that they have reached a verdict. The crowd pours back into the courtroom and takes their seats, watching nervously as the jury file back in. If the jury finds Exxon guilty of negligence, the trial will continue to the damages phase to decide how much money Exxon owes. If the jurors rule that the spill was an accident, with zero negligence on Exxon's part, then the fishermen receive nothing, and the trial will be over. The fate of more than 10,000 Alaskans hangs in the balance. Judge Holland turns to the jurors and asks the foreman if they have reached a verdict. Jury foreman Ken Murray squares his shoulders back and says, "Yes, we have, Your Honor." Murray unfolds the paper in his hands. "We find the Exxon Corporation negligent." The courtroom explodes in cheers, applause, and stomping boots. Judge Holland tries to maintain order, striking his gavel over and over, but the fishermen watching from the back of the room can't contain themselves. As they hoot and shout, Brian O'Neill holds a hand over his eyes, trying to hide his tears. It took 5 years, but the fishermen have finally been heard. Exxon will be held accountable for the damage they did to the people of Alaska. Eight weeks later, the jurors award the first round of damages. Commercial fishermen and Native Alaskans are asking for $1.5 billion in compensatory damages for decline in fish prices, permits, and marketability. But there have been no long-term studies of the continuing effect of the loss of fish and livelihoods around the fishing industry. The jury can only weigh what has happened up until now. They are given a giant stack of boxes filled with documents and a questionnaire that requires calculating the effect on 5 species of salmon over a 7-year period. One baffled jury member asks, "How are just average people supposed to figure out what these PhDs can't even agree on?" It takes them 5 weeks to do the calculations and come to a decision. And when they emerge, they award the fishermen $287 million, far less than the $1.5 billion the fishermen were asking. But lead attorney Brian O'Neill hasn't lost hope. There's still one last phase of the trial left, the punitive damage phase. The question the jury needs to determine in the amount of the award: did Exxon behave recklessly? Did cutting crew costs in half create conditions to endanger the ship? Did they overlook Hazelwood's history of drinking? The fishermen are asking for $15 billion. It's the fishermen's last chance. And O'Neill has prepared witnesses to strengthen his case. But before he can call them to the stand, Judge Holland strikes down more of the plaintiff's evidence. O'Neill isn't allowed to bring up 2 Exxon spills that occurred between 1988 and 1990 to show a pattern of recklessness on the part of the company. O'Neill also isn't allowed to show financial data about the company, which would demonstrate that Exxon makes so much money that it could afford to pay $1 billion a year for 10 years without any material impact on its business. However, the judge rules, Exxon is welcome to share evidence of the extraordinary efforts Exxon made on the cleanup. On the last day of the penalty phase, Exxon calls their final defense witness to the stand. The witness is Exxon chairman and CEO Lee Raymond. Raymond sits at the very top of the 91,000-employee Exxon hierarchy, high above the Exxon officials who were tasked with responding to the spill when it happened, men like Don Cornett, head of Alaska operations, and Frank Iarossi, Exxon shipping president. Raymond sits so high above them, he can't even remember their names in pre-trial depositions. When it's O'Neill's turn to cross-examine Raymond, he gets right to the point.
"Was Exxon reckless, Mr. Raymond? I believe the jury has already concluded that."
Raymond spent his whole career climbing to the top of a cutthroat business, and he learned to dodge along the way. O'Neill stays on him.
"But what do you think? Do you realize that self-help programs like Alcoholics Anonymous would require you to acknowledge the full scope of your mistakes before you move on with your life? I don't want to be argumentative, but I'm not looking back."
O'Neill nods. Maybe Raymond has a pressing legal reason for refusing to admit responsibility.
"Mr. Raymond, are you planning on appealing someday?"
The defense attorney yells objection, but O'Neill's already gotten under Raymond's skin.
"I can't think of a single event that shook the bedrock of this company like this. We did a major internal inquiry."
And that is what O'Neill was waiting for.
"Really, Mr. Raymond? Strange. I haven't seen a report. Do you have a copy? No. There was no report. I conveyed the findings to our board every month, verbally.
O'Neill leans against the rail of the jury box, looking from one juror to the next, and asks Raymond his last question.
So you updated your board on this every month for 3 years, but you can't remember the names of any of the key Exxon players involved.
The question hits home with the jurors. 2 weeks later, they award the fishermen $5.3 billion, the largest punitive damages award for a pollution case in the history of the United States. Outside the courthouse, Brian O'Neill stands on the steps, holding his three-year-old son in his arms. A reporter asks if he has any comment. "We're ecstatic," he says. "It's enough money that when it gets distributed among the fishermen and native Alaskans, it will allow them to make a new start on their lives." As the press begins to disperse, an Exxon lawyer comes up behind O'Neill, smiling at the boy in his arms. "Cute kid," he says. "He'll be in college before you get any of that money." Back in Cordova, Ricky Ott peers out the window of her second floor office. Car horns are blaring down below. People are dancing in the streets. She looks down First Street towards the harbor, where boat horns blare and bells ring and fishermen hug and jump up and down on the docks. It's the happiest Ricky's seen the town since the spill. That night, at the Reluctant Fisherman Inn, she overhears men and women discussing what they're going to do with the money. Pay down their houses, try to get back their boats, make equipment repairs they've been putting off since the fish disappeared. But some residents are skeptical. What if Exxon appeals? Maybe they should wait to celebrate until they actually see the money. A handful grumble that $5 billion might seem like a lot, but they'd rather just have the sound back to the way it was before the spill. In Anchorage, Exxon's temporary offices at the top of the Captain Cook Hotel are being packed up. But Exxon's attorney Patrick Lynch tells reporters this is far from over. Because back at Exxon headquarters in Irving, Texas, Chairman and CEO Lee Raymond is furious. Raymond vows to use every legal means available to overturn the verdict, even if it means taking it all the way to the Supreme Court. The appeal process will go on for 14 years. In 2006, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reduces the damages by half to $2.5 billion. And still, Exxon doesn't want to pay. They immediately file another appeal with the United States Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the fishermen of Cordova, Alaska, continue to wait. Early on the morning of June 25th, 2008, Ricky Ott sits in her kitchen reading the papers. It's been 14 years since an Anchorage jury awarded the residents of Prince William Sound $5.3 billion in punitive damages, and they still haven't received a cent. 9/11 has come and gone. Cell phones and the internet have become indispensable tools in everyday life. A lot has changed. But Ricky Ott still lives in Cordova, Alaska. She's retired from fishing to devote herself full-time to the nonprofit organization she founded to help with the lingering social and economic impact of the spill. At 6:07 a.m., her phone rings. It's reporter Yurith Rosen from Reuters. "Have you heard the news?" she asks Ricky. "The Supreme Court has come in with their decision." Ricky braces herself. "They lowered the amount, Ricky, to $507.5 million. Ricky is stunned. That's a tenth of the original award, and the rough equivalent of only 4 days' profit for Exxon. If the fishermen see any of the settlement, it will amount to about $9,000 after legal fees. Less than $500 per season since the whole affair began. After 19 years of waiting, the fishermen will receive close to nothing. Outside, wind and rain lashes at the windows of her house as a summer storm moves in. It's as if Prince William Sound itself is reacting to the news. 21,000 gallons of oil from the Exxon Valdez remain underneath the beaches of Prince William Sound, still leaching toxins into the water. The herring never returned. Many fishermen were forced to sell their boats, permits, and homes at a loss, and leave Cordova for a place where they could still support their families. Those that stayed struggle with divorce and alcoholism. Fishing incomes never returned to pre-1989 levels, and the town of Cordova will never be the same again. But some progress has been made with ship safety. A sophisticated new tanker piloting system requires that two tugboats, captained by expert local pilots, guide every oil tanker through the Sound to prevent another disaster like the Exxon Valdez. But change is slow coming. On April 20th, 2010, an underwater explosion at BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig starts what will become the largest oil spill in history, almost 20 times larger than the Exxon Valdez.
Growing concerns about the environmental threat from that rig disaster in the Gulf. It's already formed a slick measuring hundreds of square miles, and as the oil moves towards the coast, it's threatening marshes, beaches, and wildlife in four states. Brian Todd.
210 million gallons of oil spew unchecked from an open well on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico for 87 days, eventually covering 68,000 square miles of ocean. 3 weeks after the news hits the press, Ricky Ott looks out the window of Alaska Airlines Flight 709 as it begins its descent into New Orleans, Louisiana. Below her, the Gulf of Mexico stretches to the horizon, and in the distance, pale green water is blotted out by a reddish-brown patch of oil that dwarfs the slick from the Exxon Valdez. The spill is six times larger than Prince William Sound itself, and BP's fighting the spill with technology that hasn't evolved at all since 1989. Containment boom, skimmer boats, and dispersants. BP is spraying the Gulf with millions of gallons of Core Exit, the same dispersant Ricky fought to keep out of Prince William Sound 21 years ago. As Ricky's plane begins its descent into New Orleans, she takes a deep breath. Looks like the Exxon Valdez spill was just round one. Round two of her fight begins today. From Wondery, this is episode 4 of 5 of Exxon Valdez for American Scandal. On the next episode, it's been 30 years since the Exxon Valdez struck a reef in Port William Sound, but the disaster still reverberates. We bring you a conversation with marine conservation professor and Alaska fisherman Rick Steiner about the state of things today. Plus, we'll hear from a journalist who covered the BP oil spill and how it compares to the Exxon Valdez. If you'd like to learn more about the Exxon Valdez spill, we recommend the books Not One Drop by Ricky Ott and Out of the Channel by John Keeble. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, sound designed, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Additional production assistance by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Benjamin Gray, edited by Andrew Stelzer. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.